The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today I'll be reading from the October 8th, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. First, from the fiction section, a short story entitled The Rise and Rise of Annie Clark by Jean Lehure. A sign. Annie Clark is a modern woman. It's 1950, smack in the middle of the century, and she knows that the Second Great War is over and women were the real winners. Everywhere, women are taking charge of their lives. But Annie is Catholic. And so she has to go slow. Today, for instance, she is being extra patient with this young waitress, Patsy P., who is stout and clumsy and maybe new to the job. Annie is waiting for dessert, apple pie with cheese, and she figures they must be baking the pie fresh because it's taking forever. Finally, the girl brings the pie and shoves it in front of Annie and heads off without a word. Annie looks at the speck of cheese on her plate and immediately says, "Miss," but the girl keeps going. So Annie raises her napkin in the air and says loudly, "Miss!" Everybody turns to look at Annie except the waitress. She's gone. After several minutes, she comes back from wherever she's been hiding. "Miss," Annie says, the voice of endurance, "what is this, please?" "It's what you ordered." "No. I ordered apple pie with cheese." "That's what you've got," the girl says, staring beyond Annie at a future without people like this. Annie is about to say, "Bring me a slice of cheese big enough for me to see," when suddenly she is struck by how much the girl resembles her as she was at 20. Patsy P. is unattractive, with bad skin, and she is running to fat already. So nobody notices her now, and nobody ever will, except to take advantage of her. It was that way for Annie, too. In her teens, she used to joke that she was Cinderella, but without the fairy godmother. She's been taken advantage of always, even in the convent. Faced now with Patsy P. in all her unloveliness, Annie is moved nearly to tears at her own life. She manages, nonetheless, to ask for and get a larger piece of cheese. Annie eats her dessert slowly, meditating. Her kids. This morning she left for 7:30 Mass while they were still quarreling over their Wheaties, so God only knows if they got to school on time. They hate school and are rude to the nuns. Annie admits that it must be hard for them. It's a Catholic school, Sacré-Cœur, where all the classes are taught in French. But of course her kids don't know French. Catholicism comes first for Annie, and she has great sympathy for nuns, except for the mean ones. She herself wanted to be a nun. She applied to the Daughters of St. Joseph, and after a lengthy interview, she was told to wait a year or two. In time, she was accepted, and taking the name Sister Angelica, she was happy to do for God the very work she had so disliked at home. But then she was assigned a month's kitchen trial under Sister Hildegard, a German sister who took the word trial literally. In her abrupt way, Sister Hildegard asked Annie, Sister Angelica now, to go down to the cellar and bring up a bag of sugar. The cellar stairs were steep and the treads were narrow. It was a descent into the great unknown. Annie, obedient, descended. After a brief search, she located the bags of sugar, chose one, and started back up the stairs. But she was holding the bag awkwardly, and when her foot caught in the hem of her habit, the bag slipped from her arms and she went pitching forward on the stairs. The noise of her fall was terrific, and she lay there expecting someone to come and help her. She waited only a short time before realizing that nobody cared. She recovered the bag of sugar and, clutching it in one hand and her habit in the other, made her way up to the kitchen. "Oh, no," Sister Hildegard said. "Not a 10-pound bag. I need a 20-pound bag." I just fell on the stairs. I could have been killed. Well, then you must be more careful, Sister Hildegard said. Annie returned to the cellar and got a 20-pound bag. She climbed the stairs and plopped the bag down in front of Sister Hildegard. There, she said. Sister smiled at her and pointed to the bag's fancy gold label, which read, Select Brown Sugar. Not brown. I need white, she said, adding, One more trip, please. Annie stood looking at the old nun until, for the love of God and the vow of obedience, she took to the stairs once again. In the cellar, she sat down on a case of Bon Ami to rest for a while and to examine the state of her vocation. Had she really heard the call to God? She knew that life in the convent was meant to be a trial, but she had expected trials of a spiritual nature, tests of faith, but not Sister Hildegard and her 20-pound bag of sugar. It was asking too much. And she sat on her Bon Ami, despairing. Then, hosting the bag of white sugar high in her arms, she struggled once more up the stairs to the kitchen. She placed the bag of sugar before Sister Hildegard and waited for some new outrage. She did not have to wait long. I've changed my mind, Sister Hildegard said, but before she could say anything more, Annie fairly shouted at her, Whatever it is, you can go to hell and get it yourself. That evening, in conference with Mother Superior, it was decided that Annie could best serve God in some other vocation, and thus Sister Angelica was no more. Now, as she finishes her pie and cheese, Annie recognizes that you can go to hell and get it yourself was the moment she took charge of her life and stepped bravely into womanhood. Annie had lost weight in the convent, and her hair, chopped off to where beneath a veil, grew out to a fashionable length. With her new surprised expression, she looked young and attractive. So she stumbled from the convent into the arms of Willie Herbert, though she remained in her Irish heart Annie O'Flattery Clark. And in the next 7 years, she popped out 4 sturdy children. They were easy births, but 4 was enough. Too many, in fact, so she told Willie that the sex part of their marriage was over. From now on, he would have to grind out his satisfactions elsewhere. She was secretly relieved when he chose drink for his pleasure, because she had not been looking forward to having another woman in their life. The kids are now in their early teens, the eldest two, David and Mary anyway, and they are constantly in trouble. Annie's feet hurt and her heart beats too fast. She thinks she may have a condition. Her troubles are beyond number. Only last week, a cop came to the door with questions about David, who was accused of stealing candy bars from Leduc's grocery. She put him in his place, telling him a thing or two about false accusations and prejudice against the Irish, but it turned out that he, too, was Irish, Officer Murphy. She wonders now if she is pleasing to God. If so, she'd like some evidence of it. Nothing big like the saints had, just a little something to keep her going. It's not as if she were asking for lords. She decides to go and see a priest at St. Patrick's, the Irish parish, even though technically she belongs to St. Joan of Arc, mostly French. Annie dresses formally for her visit to the priest. She struggles into her girdle and her dark blue dress and then checks the mirror. She's in her 40s, but she looks 60 and she knows it. God does not care and nobody else matters, so why should she fuss? She always uses face powder and sometimes she remembers to put on lipstick. But she doesn't go in for makeup. She wears her hair short, brushed straight back, and that's fine for her. She's ready to go. She knows how rectories work. You don't just knock at the door and get to see someone. But she gives it a try anyway. She tells the housekeeper that she's got to see a priest. It's urgent and she'll wait until Father is free. Any father, no matter how long. Annie is taking charge of her life and bringing her troubles to God, or at least to the local priest who stands in for him. She waits a long 20 minutes until finally Father O'Malley enters by a side door, like a sneak. He's a young priest, tall, with reddish hair and thick glasses. They're so thick that she wonders how he can see out of them. He smiles officially and says, "Sit down," even though she's already sitting. He goes to the desk and assumes a listening pose. Annie plunges ahead. She is at the end of her rope, she says. It's her kids. They're into everything, and there's no controlling them. The oldest steals from Leduc's. Imagine! And she herself is a daily communicant and says the rosary constantly for the Pope's intentions, but nothing seems to help. 4 children, and they're all wild. They use terrible language. They pay no attention to the sisters at school, Sacré-Cœur. They're French, the sisters. Annie takes out a handkerchief, Irish lace. She is brought for the occasion. Her husband drinks. She has this pain, this terrible pain in her heart. It's all too much. Why has God given her this cross to bear? She dabs at her eyes with her handkerchief and takes a deep breath. I know, his will be done, she murmurs. Father O'Malley hears his will be done and dives right in. She is a good woman, he says, a responsible mother, and children can be a trial. But marriage and family are meant to be a trial. God intends that. He has ordained marriage for a reason, and he has blessed it with children. Hers don't sound any wilder than most kids at that age. She should remember that God has a sense of humor. God likes to see us rejoice occasionally. Father squints to get her in focus. She's very conscientious, he says. Perhaps even over-conscientious. Pray for patience. And pray for joy. Annie interrupts to ask if he will have a private talk with David, the thief. David doesn't listen to her, but she knows he would listen to a priest. She could bring him in at any time. Father O'Malley does not seem to hear her. Remember, he says, that God never gives us a heavier cross than we can bear. Pushing back from the desk, Father O'Malley says that he will pray for her, and meanwhile he manages to get her to the door. Annie turns to say one last thing about her troubles, but he's too quick for her, and she finds herself outside saying goodbye. I hope our talk has been a help, Father O'Malley says, and lifts his hand in a sort of blessing before he closes the door. Annie stands for a moment on the front steps of the rectory. What just happened? Was she given the bum's rush? Is O'Malley one of those priests who don't understand real life? And what was that about God having a sense of humor? If she believed that, she'd give up religion tomorrow. She goes next door to the church to pay a visit and say the rosary, even though she's not in the mood. The church is empty at the time of the day, the way Annie likes it, because it shows that she's doing something extra. She sits back a little so that her behind is braced against the pew. Father O'Malley said that she was a good mother, but maybe too conscientious. He could have gone into more detail on that. She's still hoping for some kind of sign. She's always wondered about divine signs and how they come to you. The stigmata, for instance. Or levitation. If you levitate, are you aware of being in the air? How high do you go exactly? Does it hurt when you land? She's had trouble with her knees ever since the convent. Saint Teresa of Avila levitated all the time, but that was in the olden days, and let's face it, nobody gets signs like that anymore. She tries for a comfortable position, but the pew is as hard as stone, and her girdle is killing her. It would be nice right now to go to a movie theater, one with those new plush seats. But she continues to sit in the pew until she finishes her rosary. Jezebel is playing at the Orpheum, and the theater is crowded. Annie doesn't approve of Jezebel, not the one in Scripture, and not Betty Davis either. But the movie should take her mind off Father O'Malley. At least he said she was a good mother. A very responsible woman, his exact words. She imagines that his own life is not easy. On the whole, she thinks, Father O'Malley tried to do his best. She replays the conversation, still dissatisfied. And then suddenly, with a great swell of music, the movie is over. Annie smiles. It's wonderful to see a woman like Betty Davis get her comeuppance. But she's late now, so she leaves while the credits are still rolling, and she finds herself outside in a heavy rain. She will be soaked through by the time she gets home. Annie puts some spaghetti in a pot of water and sets it on the gas at the lowest heat. Usually Willie does the cooking, but today is payday, so he'll stay late at the bar drinking their money away. Willie is the cook at Granger's Bar and Grill, where he shovels out hamburgers and hot dogs and shepherd's pie for a bunch of mill workers who also drink up their payday money. Annie doesn't complain. She knows that Willie has to drink, so once a week she struggles to make dinner. She's upstairs changing into dry clothes when the kids come home, all of them piling in at the same time. Annie's heart races. "Ma!" Mary calls out in that razor voice of hers. "Oh, darn," David says, looking at the stove. "Ma's cooking tonight. God lie donk." "What does that mean?" Virginia asks. "Is it dirty?" David points to the pot of spaghetti, now on the boil. "God they donk. It means, look at that," he shouts. "Hey, Ma, are you home? Ma! Hey, Ma!" And the others shout, too, until Annie can't bear it any longer and comes downstairs. She greets them with a nasty look and goes to the stove. The spaghetti is overcooked, but what can she do? She opens a can of stewed tomatoes for the sauce. "Somebody set the table," she says. She's busy cutting the tomatoes into small pieces that she dumps into a saucepan and puts on the heat. To her surprise, the kids set the table without complaint. If only they could be nice all the time. The youngest, Eddie, says to Annie, "They're saying, regardez les dons, but they say they leave off the re part. It means, look at that." Annie bends over and kisses Eddie's head. "I knew you'd catch on. French should be easy for you. Your father is French." "Well, I know merde and putain." "Don't say merde. It's a bad word." "It means feces." "What about putain?" "I'm busy now," Annie says, and upends the spaghetti into a strainer, and from the strainer she dumps it into a bowl. She can see it's a disaster, but she pours the tomatoes on top and hopes for the best. "What about putain?" Eddie asks again. Everybody sits down at the kitchen table, and Annie tries to say grace. But before she can get beyond, "Bless us, O Lord," they have discovered that the spaghetti is stuck together in a solid mass. "We can't eat this, Ma." David holds a bowl out to Mary, who digs into the spaghetti and says, "This isn't spaghetti. It's feces." "Watch your language, young lady." "It's merde," Eddie says, delighted. "We're having merde for dinner." "Eat the sauce," Annie says. "Tomatoes are good for you, and I'll open another can." "Je me fiche," Eddie says. "Me foie." They sit and take turns poking at the glutinous mass while Annie opens a large can of tomatoes. "Mary," she says, "give me a hand and get out the soup bowls. We'll have a tomato salad sort of. I'm not a cook like your father." "Why, you can say that again." "I'm sorry," Annie says. "God help me. I'm doing the best I can." She wishes she had not gone to the movie. She could have cooked something delicious. "You poor kids," she says. "Tomatoes aren't even a meal. They're a vegetable. They're merde." Willie would never serve us a meal like this. "Yay for Willie! Willie don't serve us merde!" Annie is about to break down and cry when she is saved by the unexpected arrival of Willie himself. The front door opens and Willie staggers in, drunker than usual on paydays, and relieved that he has made it home to his family. "Willie!" they all shout. "Willie's home!" "She's trying to give us tomatoes for dinner!" Mary yells. Willie holds up the large brown bag he'd been cradling in his arms and tries to say spaghetti, but he can't find the word. The kids take the bag to the table and have at it. So he has saved Annie, who is grateful and resentful at the same time. She tries so hard, but she can see that God never meant her to be a mother. She puts her shameful bowl on the kitchen counter behind the Wheaties box where nobody can see it. Willie's restaurant spaghetti is delicious, and the kids devour it as if they were starving. Annie, sick with a sense of failure, leans against the counter, while Willie dozes quietly in the rocker. Anyone looking in would think that this was an ordinary family having dinner. Then a quarrel breaks out. Annie has no idea what it's about, but David has found her sodden bowl of spaghetti hidden behind the Wheaties and set it down in the middle of the table, saying, "Okay, I dare you." Virginia, the quiet one, reaches into the bowl, makes a spaghetti snowball, and throws it hard at David. He is covered in the mucky stuff. Startled, he grabs a handful of mush from the bowl and throws it back at her. She dodges, and he hits Eddie instead. "Putain!" Eddie hollers. "Merde on you!" And suddenly they're all fighting for the bowl, shouting and laughing, and they get louder and wilder until finally Willie wakes up. He is cross now, and his speech has returned, so he shouts, "Cut it out! Show some respect for your mother!" Though he has no idea what is going on. Annie bites her knuckles, fighting the urge to scream. They all quiet down and wait to see what's going to happen. Willie begins to understand the situation. He is the father here. He should take charge. "Your mother works all day to make you a beautiful dinner, and you don't appreciate it," he says. "You should be ashamed. She's a weak woman in her condition." He wanders, of course. "Responsibility begins at home. You kids should know that. And someday I'm going to put my foot down. Put it down." And he leans back in his rocker and closes his eyes. The kids laugh, but they recognize that the fun has ended. Annie has had enough. She was not raised this way. She has been a nun in a convent. She is an independent woman. She goes to the front door to phone her sister Millie and ask if she can stay with her for the night. Millie says yes, though Annie can tell that she is hesitant. Well, too bad about Millie, who has everything and does nothing. With a prayer of thanks to Jesus, Annie seizes on her power as a modern woman. She will take her life into her own hands and let someone else do all the work for a change. She may never come back. A refuge. Annie is sitting in Millie's breakfast nook, where the sun pours in through the huge window, a bright beginning to a new day. Millie's been busy making French toast and getting the boys off to school, and Charlie off on a trip to New York, even though she's supposed to be resting. Millie has had two miscarriages since the boys were born, and after months of trying, she is finally pregnant again. And she's hurt that Annie has not even once asked about the baby. This baby is the center of her life, and Millie is terrified that something will go wrong with her pregnancy. So she's annoyed today by Annie's doom and gloom, and she's unable, in particular, to cope with her religious obsessions. Still, Annie's her sister, and she loves her. Now, Millie has tidied up the kitchen and poured fresh coffee, and they get comfortable in the living room. "Well," she says warmly, determined, "tell me all about it." Annie starts with her visit to Father O'Malley. "We had a very good talk. I think he's nearly blind, Father O'Malley, and he's got red hair." And Annie pauses and repeats, "He's got red hair." "Red hair," Millie says, "I heard you." But really, Millie's not really listening. Annie can tell. Millie has an easy life with a devoted husband who doesn't drink and two boys who are smart and well-behaved. No trouble with the cops for them. Millie was always the lucky one. Annie begins to cry. The baby, 5 months in the womb, shifts a little bit, and Millie says, "What's wrong, Annie? Or don't tell me if it upsets you." As if anything could stop her. "Oh, it's a cross. My whole life, the kids are impossible. They make fun of the nuns right to their face. The only French words they know are filth. I hate to judge, but sometimes I wonder about those French nuns." Millie is listening now, mystified. "French nuns?" "The two youngest who used to be so good hollered at that beautiful girl. The one that's the airline stewardesses. Hey, lady, you want an enema?" Annie laughs quietly. Can you imagine it? Millie goes red with embarrassment. She does not want to imagine it. Well, it's partly my fault, Annie says. Whenever they'd act up around the house, I used to threaten them with an enema. The doctor said that constipation can make them, you know, act up. And to tell the truth, at first they were just saying, hi, pretty lady, and they were being nice. But when she didn't answer, their feelings were hurt, and then they started hollering, hey, lady, you want an enema? And they followed her halfway down the street. God forbid me, I shouldn't laugh. And he says, well, they're only kids, after all, having fun. Millie says, I've got to lie down, Annie, the baby. Annie can see she's exhausted. Millie has everything, but she hasn't really taken charge of her life. Annie will say a rosary for her on the bus to Florida. Annie is listening to Stella Dallas on the radio when Millie's kids get home from school. They are full of energy, but keep their voices low because their mother's resting. They give Annie a quick kiss and then disappear into the kitchen for a snack before going upstairs to do homework. Annie, grim, thinks of her own kids coming home from school. It's like a gang raid. They attack the kitchen, complaining loudly that there's nothing to eat. They push and laugh and fight for leftovers. And when they're done, they flee the scene, leaving Annie to deal with the open jars of peanut butter and the smears of jelly and David's candy bar wrappers from Leduc. Curious, Annie looks in on Millie's kitchen once the boys are upstairs. The counter, one of those new tile ones, very pricey, is immaculate. And the whole kitchen gleams. It's true. Millie does have everything. But now, Stella Dallas is over, and Annie has missed the whole darn thing. Annie wakes Millie from her nap, in case she'd like a cup of tea and a chat. Millie sits up in bed, groggy from those new pills. She feels cranky and wishes Annie weren't there. But Annie is her sister. "Shall I make you some tea?" Annie asks. No, I'll make you the tea, Millie says, determined to be nice, and we can have a long, good talk before dinner. Millie makes tea and Annie talks. Have you ever thought about the stigmata? I've often wondered if the blood just leaks out of it or if it gushes. I imagine it must hurt. I wonder what it's like the first time it happens to you. Do you ever think of that? No, I never, ever think of that. There's this Padre Pio. He's a monk in Italy, and they say he has the stigmata. I wish they'd advertise it more. A miracle in our own times. She pauses before she risks saying, sometimes I wonder what I'd do if I received a sign like that. For God's sake, Annie, talk about something real. Annie bites her lower lip, and Millie finishes making the tea. There is a short, stressful silence. But then Millie sets out some very good spice cookies, and Annie, encouraged by the appearance of this new treat, forgets about signs and miracles and catches Millie up on the movies. She tells Millie about Betty Davis and Jezebel, and then, with more enthusiasm about the real Jezebel, the one in the Bible. Annie is pleased to show off her ease with Scripture. It's a wonderful story, she says. The Book of Kings, Kings 1 or 2, I'm not sure. Don't you love that story? Tell me more, Millie says, eager to put off until later the endless saga of Annie's troubles. The boys have gone to bed. Millie and Annie sit on the couch. Millie is waiting to hear the new personal tragedy Annie will reveal. Annie is waiting for the right moment to tell Millie that she has walked out on her family for good this time. She can't live like this any longer. She was once a nun. She has resolved to go on with her life. What is it, Annie? Millie gives in first. Annie settles into confessional mode. Her voice drops to a lower register as she begins to feel the drama, and already she is fighting tears. It all seemed to happen a year ago, but now, as Annie tells Millie, the story, the horror is immediate, and she wonders why God allows such things. But Annie is resolute and fights through to the end of her story. They say filthy words in French, They make fun of Willie, their own father, and they throw food. And food was scattered all over the kitchen. God's good food, while people in China are starving to death. And she chokes up. Annie is overwhelmed with sorrow at the waste of her life when suddenly she realizes that Millie, her foolish sister, is bent over with laughter. Millie thinks the solid bowl of spaghetti is funny. Incredible as it is, she finds Annie's tragic life to be comic. Millie laughs and says, "Oh, Annie! Sometimes I just don't get you," Annie says, "but I can assure you my life is not a joke." At once, Millie stops laughing. She finds she has run out of patience, completely out, and her long day of listening is now over. "Oh, for God's sake, Annie, you tell a funny story. You got to expect people to laugh." She is exasperated and wants to say more, but she holds back. Tentatively, Annie says, "I think I wasn't meant for marriage. I was meant to be a nun." "I believe you tried that once before," Millie says, like Betty Davis. "Well, I've made up my mind, and I'm leaving them. It's my heart. I've got a condition. I'm going to Florida for a rest." Millie asks what she will do in Florida. "What I do here? Work my fingers to the bone for ingrates?" Annie has decided that two can play at being Betty Davis. Poor Annie, the eternal martyr. "I'll pray for you, Millie. You need my prayers." "Did you get a sign from God finally? Is that it?" Now Millie has invaded Annie's spiritual life, and she is outraged, betrayed. "Was it a sign pointing to Florida? A sort of divine traffic sign?" Millie laughs, pleased with herself. It takes effort, but Annie rises from the couch and stands as tall as her short figure will allow. "I will not stay in a place where God is mocked. God will not be mocked," she says and thunders off to bed. She will never forgive Millie. This is the end. In the morning, Annie leaves by the front door, quietly, while Millie is in the kitchen making pancakes for the boys. She does not say goodbye. Outside, in the chill air, misery descends on her like rain. In fact, a hard, cold rain begins to fall, and she is overwhelmed with sadness. She wonders, frightened, if this rain has been given to her as a sign, that she's a selfish person, that she failed as a nun, and now she is failing as a mother. What does God think? And what is the matter with him anyway? Why does he stay so remote when she prays constantly? She gets off the bus and stands there, seeing herself, a woman, alone in the rain. For a second, she senses an answer to her prayers. There is no flapping of wings, no angelic greeting, only silence. And then a greater silence. She makes no defense against this wordless revelation. If she could stand naked before God, silent just like this, free of all the noise about who she is and how God feels about her, she might rise above it and become Saint Annie. For that second, she understands. Almost. But she loves her noise too much. It is her refuge, and this cannot be the sign she has prayed for, so she snaps out of it. It is sinful to ask for signs. Annie knows that. The rain is only rain and not a sign of anything. Annie packs a small suitcase with basic necessities and then writes two notes, one to her family and one to Father O'Malley. The family note is brief. "Bad heart, gone to Florida," and she tucks it beneath the clock where they'll be sure to see it. Her note to Father O'Malley is more detailed, wishing him a good health and explaining her need for rest and quiet. She asks him to stop by her place now and then, if it isn't too much trouble, to check on her family now that her husband, Willie, is in charge. She smiles as she finishes the notes. Let them all find out how easy it is to run a family. Au revoir, the whole crowd of you. Au revoir. a kind of miracle. Annie has been in Florida for nearly 2 months when Mr. Savage, the manager of the Hotel Howard, calls her in because of an ugly problem with theft. He mentions police and arrests, but after talking with her for a while, he is convinced that Annie is not a thief, but just another cleaning lady in flight from a difficult life, and now the innocent victim of a scam. He finds Annie refined, but naive and probably a little stupid. A perfect scapegoat for a hotel thief. It's an old trick. You take your valuable gold necklace from the hotel safe, being careful to sign it out. You leave it on your dressing table, and after housekeeping has cleaned the room, you discover that it has gone missing. The cleaner is the only one who has been in the room, and chances are she has been accused of something at least once before. Annie admits having tried out the woman's perfume, just a couple of sprays of Chanel No. 5. But everyone knows that the step from perfume to necklace is an easy one. The guest wants compensation for her loss. Annie sits in Mr. Savage's office and waits for him to decide her fate. Meanwhile, she says the rosary and tries to stay calm. Mr. Savage is on her side. But the Howard is an expensive international hotel that cannot afford the bad publicity of a lawsuit. So he resolves the matter discreetly, with a small financial settlement for the guest. In his subtle way, however, he lets this amateur know that he's not fooled for a minute, even while assuring her that Annie Clark will go. And so Annie is fired, with a week's wages for consolation. She sobs quietly, and Mr. Savage, a softy at heart, slides 3 extra 20s across the desk to her. Suddenly, out of nowhere, he rises from his chair and, in a way that she finds shocking, he takes her 2 hands in his. He looks at her and says, as if he cared deeply, "This isn't good, Miss Clark. This is no good for you. Go home to your family." And he continues to look at her in a way that says he knows every single bad thing about her, and it's all forgiven. She bursts into tears again, and the Florida experiment is over. The bus trip from Florida seems to take forever, but eventually Annie sees familiar churches and the Sacre Coeur school, and she knows that she's home. She's not sure what to do next. She should call Millie and get that over with, and then she can face her family. When she first got to Florida, she wrote the kids a postcard saying, "In Florida for my health, love to all." And to Millie, conscious of past favors and possible future needs, she sent a card wishing her good luck with her pregnancy. The card, however, arrived the week that Millie lost her baby. The miscarriage proved nearly fatal because Millie bled uncontrollably, and to save her life, they had to perform a hysterectomy. Annie knows none of this when she phones at Millie to ask if she can stay the night with her. Millie is cold at first, but when Annie tells her about the necklace and the false charges of theft and how she almost went to jail, Millie softens and says, "Yes, come ahead, Annie, but I'm not well, so it's just for one night." Charlie hears that Annie is on her way and says, "Are you up to this, really? I'll stay if you need me or want me, but otherwise I'm not up to this." And full of guilt, but with Millie's blessing, he leaves to spend the night at his sister's house. Annie arrives after dinner and makes herself at home. She's at her best with genuine loss, even when it is not her own, and she folds Millie in her arms and they cry together. They say little. No words of consolation can change the hard facts. Millie has lost her baby, and there will not be another one. The boys are welcoming, but subdued. They seem glad to spend the evening upstairs with their books and their radio. Annie and Millie sit together on the living room couch. Annie starts off dangerously. "God's ways are a mystery, aren't they? You can never tell why things happen to you. I mean, who would think that this would happen to you, a good Catholic from a good family?" "I don't want to talk about it, Annie. I sometimes envy the life of a nun. They're so close to God." "I suppose. God works in mysterious ways, don't you think so?" Yes. And his ways are not our ways. Annie, for God's sake, stop. You sound like a fortune teller. Oh, Millie. It's time for me to take my pills, and then let's have a snack. Millie's pills are called nerve pills, and they're something new for when she's depressed. Her doctor said to take one or two when she feels anxious or sad, and she finds that they actually work. She takes two now, even though she took two before Annie arrived. Over the past 2 months, Millie has tried to see Annie with a loving eye. And she does. But she sees her coldly. Annie is lazy, judgmental, and self-indulgent. She neglects her family shamefully. She is impossibly selfish. She hounds priests. She nags God for a private miracle, something cozy just between the two of them. And she must bore him to death with her constant praying. Meanwhile, Annie prays for Millie. Millie is her beloved sister, but she does not accept her miscarriage as God's holy will. God's will be done, Annie prays. And while she has his attention, she adds a prayer that he will be merciful tomorrow when she returns to Willie and the kids. She will not ask for a sign of his approval, but... And then here is Millie, changed into a dressing gown and looking beautiful, as if she had never, ever had a miscarriage at all. Millie makes hot cocoa, and when Annie says, I'd love one of those spiced cookies with this, or even some Ritz crackers. And she opens the bread drawer, and there are no cookies, but she finds a bag of dinner rolls left over from Sunday. They're hopelessly stale and will have to be thrown out. Millie feels funny. The pills have begun to work. Sorry, Annie, she says. We're clean out of cookies. A mad thought comes to her suddenly, and she bends over the drawer laughing. She can't stop because it's all too funny. She tries to say, it's God's holy will, Annie, but she can't speak for laughing. What is it, Annie says? What's the matter with you? Millie stops laughing, and with a perfectly straight face, she says, I'm sorry, Annie, but I've got to hit you with one of these rolls. She chooses a roll with care and pitches it at Annie. The roll strikes Annie's breast, and she yells in surprise. She looks at Millie, indignant, and reaches for her cocoa. Foolish, she says. You're just being foolish. And she turns away in disgust. Millie throws another roll, and Annie bats it away. I'm sorry, Annie, but I got to do this. It's God's holy will. And she throws another, and Annie screams in genuine fright and runs from the kitchen. You're crazy, she says. You've lost your mind. And she hides behind the dining room door. The boys come running downstairs and applaud their mother. Go, Mom, they holler. Go for it. And Millie does. She chases Annie through the living room and down the hallway, pelting her with the last of the rolls until, with one final scream, Annie locks herself in the bathroom, and the excitement is over. The boys are proud of their mother. It's like old times, and reluctantly they go upstairs to bed. Millie subsides on the living room couch, exhausted but happy. Those nerve pills, she thinks, will make me crazy in the end, but oh, what a relief from Annie's piety. Annie sleeps that night, but it is a restless sleep, disturbed by anxious dreams. Millie sobs for hours before she falls asleep, but she rises early the next morning to say goodbye to Annie. Millie's voice is kind and loving, but to Annie it is the terrible voice of the pagan Sibyl. Stop pestering God, Annie. Just leave him alone. Annie kneels, determined, before the statue of the Blessed Virgin, and tries to pray. Everything in her life is terrible. She herself is terrible, a woman overwhelmed by troubles that keep her from being a good person. She finds she cannot pray. She cannot even think. Her mind is a beehive of doubts and accusations. Less than an hour ago, she knocked on the rectory door, and Father O'Malley himself answered. He was abrupt, even hostile, and he seemed to think that she was wrong for having gone to Florida for a rest. Regarding the dictates of her note, he said he had checked her house from time to time and had found everything in good order. Willie had transferred the children to public school, where they were doing well. David seemed to have taken over the cooking. The girls made the beds and cleaned the house. And Eddie was learning French with the help of a nun from Sacré-Cœur. Father O'Malley hoped that Annie had had a good rest. In Florida, he added, his tone sarcastic. So everyone has turned on her. She is lost, and she knows it. If only she could reclaim that moment of silence when she almost saw where it was that she stood in the eyes of God. Did she almost see that? Or did she deceive herself? She closes her eyes, and immediately she hears herself thinking. And surely she is now her own miracle. I don't care anymore. I don't care about how much I matter, or how much you matter. I don't need to know anything. I just give up. I give in. I want nothing. I surrender. And with that, she falls asleep, kneeling upright at the altar rail before the statue of the Virgin Mary. Annie sleeps a good, unfeeling sleep. She knows nothing. She wants nothing. Now slowly, gently, she rises in the air, kneeling upright as she ascends to a height of exactly 3 feet 2 inches, still sleeping soundly, aware only that she has surrendered, whatever that means. She knows nothing of what is happening to her. Father O'Malley comes from the sacristy, genuflects before the altar, and stops to stare with his single good eye, blurry as it is, at what looks to be a woman levitating. He stares harder, and sees that she is that tiresome Annie Clark, and without doubt she is kneeling on the empty air. He blesses himself, genuflects again, and goes back into the sacristy. Annie eventually descends from the air, sleeping still, and when she awakes, she has no knowledge of what has happened. She is embarrassed at having fallen asleep in church, and her knees hurt from kneeling so long, but she is strangely rested and refreshed. In the sacristy, Father O'Malley ponders, to what end would God suspend his law of gravity this way? For whose benefit? And why? Annie Clark seems an unlikely candidate for his special attention, as he himself, half blind and half useless, is. Still, he is pleased to have been chosen as a witness to the levitation of this annoying woman. Perhaps the age of miracles has returned. Or more likely, God is simply in one of his antic moods. It's not useful to examine this kind of thing too closely, he knows. Still, you have to wonder. Next, from the critics' pop music section, an essay entitled The Weight, Cat Power Details the Melancholy of Letting Go, by Amanda Petrushik. Chan Marshall was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1972 and raised in North Carolina and Tennessee. She came of age as a musician in New York, where in the early 1990s she began recording under the name Cat Power. Her first releases, made with the drummer Steve Shelley of Sonic Youth, reflect the city's antagonism and discord. Sometimes, when you are young and far from home, it feels good to camp out in the corner of a dim, sticky dive, strum a single chord on a two-string guitar, and mumble the word no for 15 minutes. Marshall is now 46. In the decades since her debut, she has provided a rare and important template for generations of indie rock singers, and particularly for young women trying to come up in an aggressively male genre. It's not difficult to draw a direct line from Marshall to contemporary artists such as Mitski, Angel Olsen, Phoebe Bridgers, Snail Mail, and Soccer Mommy. Tough, but vulnerable singers who write and often produce their own material independent of a band. Wanderer, released this week, is the first Cat Power album since 1996, not to be on Matador, the independent record label that signed Marshall shortly after she moved to New York. The album is being put out by Domino. In a recent interview, Marshall has suggested that Matador pressured her to write hits. She told the Times that an executive at the label had played her an Adele record for inspiration. A spokesman for Matador responded that the label and Marshall had faced, quote, disagreements over matters both artistic and business, end quote, but that Chan Marshall is without question one of the most talented, brilliant artists we've been fortunate enough to know. In 2015, Marshall gave birth to a son. He appears on the cover of Wanderer, alongside the neck of an electric guitar. Although in the past, Marshall has returned in a musical sense to the landscapes of her childhood, most notably on The Greatest from 2006, which she recorded with a crew of Memphis studio musicians, many culled from the Stax and High Records house bands. Wanderer has a more explicitly Southern sensibility than anything else she's done. Her interest in soul and blues idioms remains, but she has never sounded more like a folk singer. Wanderer is about the complex, protracted condition of leaving home only to spend the rest of your life plagued by some invisible force luring you back. On much of the album, Marshall connects to a lineage of American searchers, from the itinerant bluesmen of the pre-war Delta to drifting troubadours like the Texan folk singer Townes Van Zandt, all restless spirits who took off with only their songs to sustain them. Marshall is largely uninterested in the trappings of modern adulthood and seems to place little value in the notion of being held down or in holding someone else down. But a life of even gentle goodbyes can still exhaust a person. The title track details the melancholy of letting go. Wild heart, young man, goddamn, I never wanted to keep. For your gold is ages old before the end of your story. Give my hand to Jesus when it went away with you. Oh, wanderer, I've been wondering. Marshall's lyrics have always been at least vaguely concerned with heartbreak, but she's rarely specific about its origins. Instead, her wistfulness is omnipresent. You get the sense that she knows more than anybody should about the internal seesaw of love and loss. Twist of fate would have me sing at your wedding with a baby on my mind and your soul in between, she sings. There's something hazy and calm in her voice that calls to mind bouncing along a dirt road at sunrise, watching the horizon slowly come into focus, the pink hope of a new morning, and it is a clear shot out of town. Wonder isn't quite an unaccompanied ballad. Her own voice is layered behind her in a ghostly self-harmony. But it nonetheless recalls the early recordings of Appalachian singers who unleashed plaintive songs of sorrow with no instrumental backing. Marshall's performance here has a similar feel, unmediated and pure. Most of her songs dissect or lament some sort of struggle, but her vocals never sound strained or even especially effortful. Her phrasing is its own miracle. The album closes with a reprise of sorts, Wanderer / Exit, which features the same lyrics, now set to a minor key melody that resembles that of Leadbelly's In the Pines. It's darker and moodier, imbued with foreboding. It suggests that wandering, as both a lifestyle and a philosophy, can be as lonesome as it is liberating. If you never stay long enough to plant your feet for a fight, you will never know the catharsis and relief of forgiveness. For a brief period in the mid to late aughts, Marshall became known for her erratic live performances, which sometimes ended before they began, or included moments when she faced away from the audience. When I interviewed her in 2012 at her home in Miami Beach, she told me about hearing voices on a recent flight from Nashville. The experience terrified her. Not long afterward, she checked into the psychiatric ward of Miami's Mount Sinai Medical Center, where doctors told her that she was experiencing an acute psychotic break. On her recordings from this era, from The Greatest through Sun, Marshall sometimes sounds just out of reach, as if her body had shown up at the studio, but her mind was elsewhere. On Wanderer, she seems whole and present again. Her past imbues her new work with empathy and weight. Woman, a duet with Lana Del Rey, explores ideas of recovery and self-knowledge. The doctor said I was better than ever. Man, you should have seen me. The doctor said I was not my past. He said I was finally free. In interviews, Marshall is often jittery and verbose, but in the studio she is remarkably concise. She has long known how to build a few spare electric guitar strums into something rich and resonant. Woman becomes a kind of trembling manifesto. I'm a woman, I'm a woman, I'm a woman, I'm a woman, Marshall and Del Rey insist. Both singers have had to publicly reckon with complex past and been subject to sexist commentaries on their stamina, talent, and authenticity. When they harmonize on the chorus, it feels as if that one sentence contains everything an observer might need to know about them. Cat Power has rarely been a group project, and Marshall performed and produced Wanderer by herself. Most of the album is just guitar, piano, and her unfussy vocals. But Marshall is also an instinctive collaborator who has made two records using other people's songs. Even if a melody isn't Marshall's own, her voice is so deep and expressive that it can be bent to suit almost anything. Stay, which appears on Wanderer, was written by Justin Parker and Mickey Echo and made famous in 2012 by Rihanna. It recounts the terror of falling in love, how the process subjugates people, leaves them vulnerable. Over a handful of echoing piano notes, she transformed Stay into a fragile, yearning torch song about the pain of wanting someone. Stay is an admission of desire, a brave and frightening thing for a born drifter to cop to. In the context of Wanderer, any entreaty to linger, however tortured, feels instantly profound. Well, we've run out of time. I hope you enjoyed listening to my broadcast as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, triangleReadingService.org. And that's it for today. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.